Yeah. Good evening. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink, since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful to God for that. I'm grateful that Richard is free of cancer. It's a miracle. And I'm grateful Chet made it here with my buddy from New Jersey. You flew down only for this meeting, correct? You made it just in time, Chet. It's good to see you.
I heard
your
body.
Yeah, right. I'll be the wine buyer tonight. Yeah. So it's good to be. Listen, this is a great step. I love this step, and I'm going to try to control myself during it. You know. So I have a little poem I want to read you, a little something that some of you have heard before, to sort of get us in the mood, get me in the mood, which I kind of like. I kind of like this deal. I'm sort of like a one-trick pony. I mean, there's a lot of repetition in my steps. I have one story, I have one song, I have one deal, I have one theme. It's very simple. It's 12 weeks of what purports to be the steps, but it's really 12 weeks of the third step. And masquerading as a step series. This is called The Old Violin. 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. "What am I bidding, good folks?" he cried. "Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar, now two, only two, $2, and who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no." From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. Then, wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up all the strings, he played a melody pure and sweet as an angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, "What am I bid for the old violin?" And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? $3,000 once, and $3,000 twice, and going and gone, said he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, "We do not quite understand. What changed its worth?" The man replied, "The touch of the master's hand." And many a man with his life out of tune and battered and torn with sin is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once and going twice. He's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand. We're at a step tonight which starts off in the 12 and 12, and I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to stick to one sentence. We're going to do this whole meeting is going to be about one, maybe two sentences. It's going to be about one paragraph in step six. We're not going to leave one. See, one of the problems I have as an alcoholic, I don't know, maybe regular people have this problem, is I tend to see things the way I want to see them. I see things in such a way so that it makes me comfortable. I don't like being uncomfortable. And, you know, I told this little story, and I'll try to do the shortened version of it, but it's true. You know, my first wife was married 5 years, beautiful wife, beautiful child. One day I came out, and I was dressed to the nines going into work. And, you know, she looked at me, holding our five-year-old son. And she said, "You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." And she said it in such a way that it was pretty clear. She wasn't there to argue. She was just sort of like delivering the mail. I just wanted to know, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. And I heard every word she said, and there wasn't a whole lot of words in that. Pretty straightforward. And I got in my car and I drove down the street. And when I got to the first light, I sat there and I thought, I said, "What the hell did she mean by that?" Now, when that kind of stuff confuses you, marriages don't last long term, and that one broke up. Because they didn't quite understand what she meant by that. And what I've realized is that I rationalize. I tell myself rational lies. I tell myself lies that make sense to me. One of the reasons we do the fourth and fifth step is so that we can sort of map things out in such a way so that we can, and bring it before another person, so we can somewhat honestly understand and gauge the crap we've led ourselves to believe. And maybe over a period of 20 or 30 years of staying sober and going through that same process while we're being honed down through life and being beaten up, we might learn enough so that we might actually realize how selfish we really are and how much it's hurting us. And maybe we'll give up, maybe four or five old ideas. And life will get a little bit better. And that's sort of like the way it works, really slowly. What happens is I understand that even though I read the big book, and I like to think I'm a smart person, as an alcoholic, I'd like to think I'm the smartest person. I read this book, this big book, it's a big book. And I read the 12 and 12. The truth of the matter is, I don't really read it. I don't really get it. My first wife said the simplest thing to me. She said, "You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." There's no sentence simpler than that in the big book. And I didn't understand that. You understand? I didn't understand that. And everybody in here, every alcoholic in here, somewhere along the line, has been told something loud and clear, probably 17 times by 300 different people, a sentence like that, and it like went right over your head. Or you said, "What are they talking about that?" Or you went on to the next thing, you just didn't get it. Until one day you got fired, or one day, you got fired. What's it? Well, we've been telling you. Or one day you went to jail. Or one day something happened and you ran headlong into reality and you woke up in a treatment center and 5 years later you stand before a group and all of a sudden you understand something that you should have understood about 20 years ago. And so when you come from a position where you lie to yourself and you lie to other people and you think you understand, you don't really get it because yourself will run riot, though you usually don't think so. And you're filled with selfishness, and you only have one brain, and the only brain you can filter this through is your own brain, and it's a selfish, self-centered brain, and dishonest to boot. And you don't want to do this stuff anyway, because you're hair-triggered against the God idea, because, who knows better about the world? Because I'm God. I must think I'm God. Because my basic text says, and I believe this basic text before I believe my own mind, because my own mind got me in here. My basic text says, first of all, we got to quit playing God. So if my basic text says, the first thing alcoholics do is they got to quit playing God, they must say that because alcoholics must apparently play God. That must be part of the disease, whatever that means. And so if I don't even understand simple sentences like that, and you throw me this book, I mean, no wonder we need sponsors and meetings, and you throw me this book, which is loaded with like 1,000 sentences like that, how can I ever BS myself into believing that I actually understand what the heck's going on here? Now, I'll tell you what's really interesting to me. The older I get, I'm 64 years old now, I've been sober 32 years, the more I tend to, instead of focusing on the entire book, although I read the entire book, I focus on a sentence at a time. I pick apart the sentence. I do it the way the rabbis did it, you know, when they're going over the Talmud or something like that. And I go to a lot of Bible studies. That's the way we do it in Bible study. We're going over the Old and New Testament. We just pick apart the words. And then somebody says, well, this is what this word means in Greek, and this is what this word means in Aramaic. That's what this word means in Hebrew. You know, this is what this word means in, and we just pick apart the words until, and we have arguments over what little words mean and everything like that. And somehow, some way, we sort of look at this from all angles and we get different things. Sentences, words. That's the way I start reading the big book. And I got to tell you something else. It's sort of like, if you've been around for a while, you'll understand where I'm coming from. The longer I came in here in 1981 with the mind and soul and whatever and the ideas and the attitudes of somebody from 1981. The longer I studied this book, the longer I'm in here, the more I focus on this thing from a 1935 to 39 point of view. And I try to talk about this at meetings. I'll probably talk about this as to why I do that. Because I want to be as pure as possible. I mean, I want to drink from the pure stream of whatever these guys were drinking from in 1935. Because when I read what they say was going on in their lives, when I read when they say that they were rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, that they experienced much of heaven, that they lost fear today, tomorrow, and the hereafter, that they were reborn, that they had a new freedom and a new happiness. When I read the stuff that's going on with them and what happened to them, and when I read what their lives were about, which was so much more than just not drinking, and I look at what's going on in AA today, I realize that whatever was going on with them back then, what they were talking about in the book, is not happening today in AA as a whole. Now, if you want to get mad at me and say, well, he's putting down, I'm not putting down AA. I love AA, you know, because the great thing about AA is it gets large groups of people that can hear all sorts of points of view, okay? But it's not going to stop me from talking about what I've learned over 32 years. You know, AA is like a giant toolbox. There's a wrench to fit every nut that walks through the door. I'm not necessarily here to talk to you or the person sitting next to you, but there may be somebody who's interested in my point of view, and you're free to take it or leave it. And what I'm here to do is not give you the party line or to compromise the message in such a way so that I don't offend anybody. I want to be offended. You know, if you're not offending at least 20% of the people, you're probably not saying much of anything. And you're certainly not changing anybody's life. All you're doing is entertaining people in Alcoholics Anonymous in such a way so that they'll like you, which is just as much a disease of alcoholism, the please love me, don't reject me deal as anything else, whether you want to call it codependency or whatever you want to hear. So my job here is to be as transparent as possible and try to give you my experience. And what my experience is the longer I'm in here and the more of the blessings that come into my life from doing this stuff, the more I realize that the closer I get to the way they were doing it from 1935 to 1939, the better this thing operates for me, and the stronger the power of God in my life is, and it manifests in me. So I sort of feel like Bill Wilson felt back in 1939 when he said to Bill Dodson's wife, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. He was so imbued with the fact that God had taken this thing from him and continued to work in his life that he was compelled to talk about it. He was compelled to talk about it. You know, I don't see that compulsion in AA here today. I see just the opposite. And it's sort of scary when I look at what's going on in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in our basic text, and I look at the, quote, wisdom of the rooms. The wisdom of the rooms. And so what I want to do is I want to concentrate, and this is, I know of no better step to work this thing out on. Because, you know, we've been through steps. Hey, I apologize to you if this is the first time. You're just coming in here cold, okay? But most of these people have been here for steps 1 through 5, so I make no apology. We're not on the first step or the second step. We're on the sixth step. We've been through this, so you guys sort of know what to expect. So we happen to be on that step, quite frankly, where we're going to separate the men from the boys. Because this is the step that separates the men from the boys. You know, and I can tell you what, I have no question, there's no question in my mind. The men, and I guess the counterpart would be the women from the girls. There's no doubt in my mind, the men, whatever they call the men in this deal, will have no problem with this message. The boys will be very uncomfortable. It'll be a very uncomfortable message for them. There'll be a lot of gossiping going on, a lot of stuff like that going on. Did you hear what that guy had to say? Do you believe that bullshit and all that sort of stuff, you know? Just remember, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. Or as I like to say, when you throw a rock into a pack of dogs, the one that yells the loudest is the one that gets hit. So we're going to concentrate on, really, I'm going to sort of read some other stuff, but we're going to concentrate on one line and try to figure out, trying to piece what this means. Sort of like the line, you know, when if you come home drunk one more time, imagine if I had really sat down and thought about that. If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I'd probably still be married to the gal. Who knows what would be going on? But, you know, it's sort of like when, so I want to just concentrate on this one line that they lead off with, because it's probably important. It says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. By the way, I want to point out something to you. This may, you may get some, there may be a byproduct from this. There may be some incidental revelations that you get from this down the road. And I'm going to give you one. If you know anything, I don't know how many people have actually worked the steps, gone through the steps. You know, there's the fourth, the fifth step. And then we have something called the eighth and the ninth step that have to do with personal relationships. If you read the eighth step and you read the ninth step, what you'll realize is that the eighth step comes directly, now listen to me, directly from the fourth step. It even says, when you work the eighth step, we have a list of people we have harmed, came out of our fourth step. So you may want to ask yourself the question, just for the heck of it, if the eighth step comes right from the fourth step and the fifth step, and the ninth step comes right after the eighth step, why is the eighth and ninth step the sixth and the seventh step? In other words, why is six and seven, why is eight and nine separated by six and seven? And I'm not going to even give you that answer. Maybe somewhere along the line I'll give you that answer. But if you start understanding what the difference is between the men and the boys, you'll understand why there's a difference, why the eighth and ninth step is separated by six and seven, why you have to get through six and seven in order to actually do eight and nine, and why only the six and seven, the people who actually do six and seven, experience the promises that are promised after 8 and 9. There is a direct correlation between experiencing permanently, every day, the incredible promises that are after 8 and 9 and going through 6 and 7. Because 6 and 7 separates the men from the boys. And let me tell you something, the boys get sober, the men get permanent emotional sobriety. They get something different than just being, just not drinking. They get something, because you know something, I've met those guys. They're around. They're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every once in a while you'll run into them. There's a difference. I mean, there's golfers and then there's Tiger Woods. You may not like that, but there is. There is a difference. There is a distinction. And you don't have to call me some sort of heretic or some sort of elitist, because all I'm doing is reading from our literature. Our literature doesn't say everybody gets the same thing. It doesn't even say do whatever the hell you want to do. It says rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, which I guess means if you don't follow our path, you're not going to get what we got. It says this is the step that separates the men from the boys. So declares a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of A.A.'s greatest friends. So, I mean, that tells me two things. There's a separation between men and boys, whatever they are. And quite frankly, my feeling right now is probably when they say men and boys or women and girls, probably the mature person, the men and the women, that's the good thing. The boys and the girls, you don't want to be there. That's another thing that separates the men from the boys. People who can't turn off their cell phones during a meeting. That's another thing. Of course, that could be everybody can have an accent like that. I understand that. Turn off your cell phones, for God's sakes. God's sakes. You know, when they say, if you're willing to go to any length to get this, I know most of you think they want me to kill my mother or climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Any length in Alcoholics Anonymous parlance is just turn off your flipping cell phone. Listen, if you can't take the time and you're so selfish that you can't turn off your cell phone, you'll never stay sober. Because you got your head too far up your ass. You get it? I'm just trying in a very meek and gentle way to explain something that anybody above the age of eight, should understand. Now, I understand I'm talking to alcoholics, so the mean age is 3. I get that. Just turn it off, okay? Actually, it's a good thing when that stuff like that happens, because it's like a prop for me, you know what I mean? It only would upset you if you're upsettable. You know, I think this is God's way of saying, hey, you ought to point this out to these guys. They need to see alcoholism in action. It's not drinking. This is what alcoholism looks like after you stop drinking. You can't turn off your cell phone and a group of other people. That's what it looks like. You can't stop talking during the movie. You know, you can't stop texting. This is alcoholism. This is exactly what it looks like, selfishness. He goes on. So what does this tell me right off the bat? It tells me a couple things. There's a separation between the men and the boys. There is a separation. And number two, apparently these guys like clergymen. Apparently when you go into almost every AA meeting, I don't know because I haven't been to every AA meeting, but there seems to be some sort of understanding in AA based upon the wisdom of the rooms, the fellowship. You know, Well People's Anonymous here. Religion bad, AA spirituality good. Alky spirituality good, religion bad. When the people that drove and inspired Bill Wilson were clergymen. And they were inspired by religion, and all they did was read the Bible. And the big book, our basic text, I'm not talking about a fellowship, says we lose prejudice. Even against organized religion, we begin to see where religious people are right. Now, I'm just talking about what our program is, what our real program is, the way they thought and their attitudes in 1935 through 1939, when they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, who think like we think, who have developed the attitude we developed, have done the things we developed. Of course, I'm not talking about the attitude of an alcoholic, a typical alcoholic in the year 2013, which is so far from what was going on when they wrote this book, it's ridiculous. You need to read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. It may change your attitude as to what AA really is. Just like when I didn't get, when my wife said, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. You see, you know what I thought she said ultimately? What I thought she said ultimately is, okay, go to the bar and have a few drinks, but just get home sober, you know? That's not what she was saying. Because I tried it didn't work, and that was the end of the marriage. Do you think it's possible as an alcoholic to read a book about God and about connecting to God and growing in the connection with God and having God change your life, to read that book, a book that tells you, by the way, you're an alcoholic and you hate this crap, and you don't want to go there, and this kind of thinking has to be abandoned. Knowing you hate this stuff, knowing you want to play God, knowing you want to run your life, knowing you hate religion, knowing you're hand-triggered against, do you think it's possible to read a book that's trying to turn you in the completely opposite way and come up with all the wrong ideas to what you think they're saying? If you're an alcoholic, you better believe it. You could be thinking you're doing this program, you're not even close to it. And somewhere along the line, when you start drinking and drugging again, or maybe you don't start drinking and drugging again, maybe you stay sober, but you just feel crappy about yourself and other people and you can't get a decent relationship going and everything around you is selfish and self-centered and you just feel sorry for yourself all the time and life isn't going good, you start thinking, what's going on with the program? I'm working the program, and you're not working the program. You're working something, and it's your program, but it's not even close to what they were working. Because you're actually one of the girls, or you're actually one of the boys. You ain't one of the men. Because you ain't doing this right, because you read it wrong. You didn't get it. This is the step that separates the men from the boys, so declares a well-loved clergyman who happens to be one of A's greatest friends. He goes on to explain, you know, that's because Bill Wilson had a lot of friends that were clergymen. Sam Shoemaker sort of like was a spiritual sponsor. Ed Dowling was a spiritual sponsor. That's where the steps came from. He was close and tight with them. That's where they got all their stuff from. They read the Holy Bible. How many of you guys are tight with one or two or three clergymen? Don't raise your hands, you know. I'm just making a point here. Between 1935 and 1939, the leaders of this deal, this movement, this thing, were tight with the church. They went to church. They listen, in two parts of this book, they say we encourage church membership. Not all of us feel that way, but most of us do. I'm quoting directly from the book. But most of us do. They became part of church families. In the family afterwards, they say, a person who's doing this thing, we recommend they join a church with their family. Now, this may shock you, seeing as how we're in AA and we're spiritual, not religious. You know, well, you have a different kind of alcoholism than I do. I'm selfish, not spiritual. You see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm selfish, not spiritual. I'm selfish. That's what I am. Now, it so happens that as a result of becoming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I become religious. I religiously go to Bible study. I religiously hang out with other people that are seeking God. I religiously go to AA meetings. I religiously follow rules that I would never follow in my life. I religiously read stuff written by other people over thousands of years having to do with God. I religiously do that. And because I religiously do that, and I do all that stuff, I have some semblance of spirituality. If I stop doing that stuff, you know what I become? A selfish, self-centered son of a bitch, which is really what I am. So I have a pretty good idea of what's really going on inside of me, because I lived with myself for 64 years, and I know what's really going on. And I know that anything that's good and decent in me hasn't come from me. I give all credit for him, just like Bill Wilson did. Just like they all did. You know, I don't give credit to the fact that I'm God and I can do good orderly direction. I can't do good orderly. I'm an alcoholic. I'm powerless. I can't do good orderly direction. I can't even do the next right thing. I can do it once in a while, but I don't delude myself into thinking, well, I'm really good at this next right thing. I'm really good at this good orderly direction thing. Man, I got this thing down. You know what I mean? No. Because I have a book that I believe in. It's the basic text. It says if a mere philosophy of life or a basic change of philosophy would have cured us, we would have been sober a long time ago. But it didn't do us. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. So we had to find a power greater than ourselves, which is why we have this book and we talk about God. And it says here's where alcoholics get all pissed off. And then it says this kind of thinking has to be abandoned. I mean, I'm involved in the, I don't know what organization you're involved in. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I read this book, I believe that stuff. I don't believe what I want to believe or what some group tells me I should believe because it makes them feel uncomfortable to believe something else. I believe in this book. Now, I'm not saying I understand what it's like to be an alcoholic and succumb to peer pressure and not want somebody to laugh at you and everything like that. And I guess one of the benefits of having 32 years is you somewhere around 28 or 29 years, you realize they really can't fire you from this thing. So, you know. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness and honesty to try repeatedly on step 6, on all his faults without any reservations whatever, has indeed come a long way spiritually and is therefore entitled to be called a man. This is the test. Are you a man or a woman who are trying to grow in the image and likeness of your Creator? You know, that's what these guys said this thing was all about. It said the men are trying to grow in the image and likeness of their Creator. You know why? Because they were deists. They believed in God. That's why Bill Wilson said the Lord. That's why Dr. Bob Smith said if you're an atheist, you're agnostic, or have any other form of intellectual pride that keeps you from understanding these simple words we say in this book, I feel sorry for you. Your heavenly Father will never let you down. They were talking about God. That's why the name is all through the book. The image and likeness of your Creator, which has got to be difficult if the Creator really is a doorknob, or a tree or something, you know what I mean? I'm just reading the material. And I'm trying to read it in such a way, in a commonsensical way, rather than the way I used to look at the material, like when my wife said, "We come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you," in a way that makes me feel good. Because if I look at this thing the way they were looking at it in 1935, doing quiet sessions, doing prayer sessions, reading the Holy Bible, you know what they said in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers? They said the books we found absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. That means essential. Absolutely essential. Our 1 Corinthians 13, the Sermon on the Mount, and the book of James. Interesting thing about 1 Corinthians 13, there's a line in there in 1 Corinthians 13. I understand where they got this separation from the men of the voice, because in 1 Corinthians 13, it says this: "When I was a child, I talked and felt and thought like a little child. Now that I am a man, my childish speech and feelings and thoughts have no further significance for me. When I was a child, I thought like a child. When I became a man, I put childish things away." Childish things. You know, you go to AA meetings. I go to AA meetings. How many times do you hear people talk about childish stuff? How many times do you hear 40-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 60-year-olds talk about stuff, complain about stuff that you would expect to come out of the mouth of a 12-year-old or an 18-year-old or a hormonal 25-year-old? How many times do you hear real wisdom coming out from somebody talking about the real deal, what life is really about, in an AA discussion meeting? You know, I mean, there's a separation here. There really is a separation between childish attitudes and godly attitudes. There's a separation. This book, if it hasn't been clear to you from the... Listen, let me read you a couple of things, you know, and just to underscore the deal. "We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less." You know, when it says, like, the great fact, I think that's something you need to pay attention to. The great fact. You know, here's one of the facts, or look at this fact, or, you know. The great fact is just this. And not, by the way, they say the same thing in several places, in the back of the book, too. "That we have had a deep and effective spiritual experience which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe." There's a complete attitudinal change in alcoholics from the way we were worshiping, idolizing, running after the women, the men, the romance, the sex, the cars, the things, the stuff. And none of us do it perfectly. I get it, because it's all out there and we're inundated with it. But for us, for the men, there's a complete attitude change between what's important and what we focus on, okay, and what we used to focus on. The central facts. So what is the change? The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He, meaning God, has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Now, just in case you think they might have accidentally said that, you know, they had nothing else to write down, and they, you know, they didn't really mean that. It says here, later on in the book, "Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, a different plane, a different view of the world, a different worldview." You know, I was talking to somebody, I'm not even going to mention who it was somebody who used to be very high up in the government, about what's going on in Washington and a whole bunch of things in politics, and he says, and I said, "Why it's happening?" And he said, "You know, Russell," he says, "you got to understand something. You and I have a different worldview of theirs. We see things completely different. We see this world and what's going on in this world and the people and the motivations completely different than they do, because we're believers. We believe there is a God, and we see things differently, and they believe that men are gods, that we're like the top deal, and our thinking is the top deal. We see things differently. You know, we just look at the world differently. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God." You see, I think what they're saying here is if you're an AA and you're one of the men and you're doing this thing, you're on a different basis. Your basis is you trust and rely upon God, not upon yourself, upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the world he, role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely upon him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? See, the men, what they want to know is, what is the work God wants me to perform? What is his will for me? Because I've turned my will and my life over the care of God. The boys think that's stupid. Do you understand what I just said? The boys think that's stupid. The men base their life on it. These men base their life on that. You can chuckle if you want, but that's what this book is about. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our own creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness, paradoxically is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Outgrow fear, which is the corrosive thread of your lives. That's what runs you. All you do is think about, what is he going to say? What is she going to say? What do they think about me? What's going to happen? All your whole life is me, 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 fear, 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 me, me, fear, fear, fear. The men outgrow that deal. Even fear of death. It goes on to say, I mean, just in case you think they didn't mean that, you know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here. It says, envision for you at the very end. What does it say? It says, but you may have the benefit of you, that you want to have contact with. It says, but still you may say, we will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. You know, people that focus on God create godly fellowship of other people who focus upon God. And you know what their conversations are about? They converse and they think about and they talk about God. If you're not conversing about God, if you're not thinking about God, if you're not discussing God, if you're not involved in that stuff, then you're just not involved in that stuff. And that should tell you a lot about the difference between you and the people that wrote this book. And that should explain to you why you feel the way you feel, even though you've been doing this for 5 or 10 or 15 years. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do for each day for the man who's still sick. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You want great events, you see that your relationship with him is right. Prior in the book, what it says also, it says, when we make this a sincere decision for God, a sincere decision. You know what a sincere decision is? You don't cower among people when you're talking about God because you're worried about what they think about you, because God is more important than whether or not the Life is Good group likes you. That's a sincere decision, okay? When we make a sincere decision, it says all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all-powerful, God will give you everything you need if you stay close to him and perform his work well. He'll even cure you of cancer. He'll do amazing things for you. He'll even touch your life. He'll do amazing things for you. It says you'll lose fear today, tomorrow, the hereafter. You'll even lose some degree of selfishness. It says that's how we do it. It says we must get rid of selfishness. It kills us. God makes that possible. It says we were reborn. The whole thing is about God. And so we have this step 6. What do you think they mean when they say this is the step that separates them from the boys? And then they talk about something that most alcoholics don't want to talk about, becoming righteous before God. That's what this whole thing is about. I know you hate the word righteousness. You know what righteous means? The word righteous means right standing before God. It means standing for the right thing in godly ideals. And you want to say, if you don't think there is some godly ideals, let me say, God's described pretty good in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all about honesty, it's all about faith, it's all about love, it's all about compassion, it's all about service, it's all about sacrificing your life. Like, you want to see who God is? Why don't you read the part where it says you got to be the Good Samaritan every day, that a kindly act once in a while isn't enough, that you got to sacrifice your entire life. It says you may lose many nights' sleep. It may be great interruptions of your business. You may sacrifice your money and your time just to help another alcoholic. You want to know about God? That's what a life. You know, they said to Mother Teresa, the guy who followed her around from the New York Times, says, "I'd never do what you do. I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million." She said, "Neither would I." You know, the guys that are imbued with this program, they sacrifice their time, their energy, their life, and their money to try to carry this message to other people all the time. The other guys say things, "Well, that's too far. It's all the way to Miami." "Well, there's a basketball game on tonight." "I don't think so." They're not interested in sacrificing. They're interested in putting their life and their comfort before what God wants them to do. Because they're sober because they're powerful. They're sober because of the work they did. It has nothing to do with God. Those are the boys in the group. They'll do AA as long as it doesn't interfere with the crap they want to do in their life, which is more important, because they're selfish, self-centered, and it's all about them. But you can always tell the guys that are, you know, have got this thing, because they're not reaching for they're not trying to settle. They're not reaching for the prize where just as long as they like me in AA and they keep on handing me my medallions. They're looking for another. They're looking to please and have a relationship with somebody other than, I don't know, the leader of the group in Alcoholics Anonymous or the Life is Good group. Their focus is someplace else. You know, the real question you got to ask yourself is, where is your faith? So that's what step six is all about. That's what step six asks. Step six asks the question, where is your faith? You can tell me all your, where is your faith? What do you think about all the time? You know, what are you focused on? Where is your focus? Where is your faith? Who do you really turn to? Who do you really think is in charge? Who have you turned your life over? What do you really think? What is your life really about? That's what step six is all about. You read through step six. It says in step six right here, it says, some people, of course, may conclude that they are indeed ready to have all such defects taken from them. But even these people, if they construct a list of still milder defects, will be obliged to admit that they prefer to hang on to some of them. Therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life, according, of course, to our various and sundry ideas what will get us by. I get that attitude. Just do this good enough to get by and still be able to do the crappy stuff I want to do. Stay out of my life. You work your program, I'll work my program. I understand what it's like to be in here and look down on religious people who are trying to live a righteous life and praying to God. They're goody-two-shoes. They're looking down on us. They're self-righteous. I understand why it's good to put them down, because if you can put them down, then you don't have to at least try like they try, and you can continue doing the horse shit that you do and feel good about yourself. I get that. And I understand why that's important for newcomers in AA. I understand why for new people in AA who feel so shitty about themselves and so crappy about themselves and are so used to being put down or so ready to think that other people are putting them down, I get why it's so important to be light and airy and saying, "Hey, don't worry, and don't worry about that. You know, you raped three chickens. Everybody rapes three chickens, you know. I raped three chickens, you know, and made love to a moose. It's okay." I get all that, okay? I understand that. I understand about grace and love and everything. And I also understand that when I was a child, I thought like a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. I understand that there is a time in AA where you have to really start growing up and taking responsibility. And stop making believe that you're 18 years old and it's okay to continue, just because you're not drinking, it's not okay to continue doing the crap that you're doing. And that everybody that looks you in the eye and says, "Stop doing that crap, what's wrong with you? Maybe you ought to do this," is not your enemy. They may be your best friend. They may be trying to lead you to a place that'll make you feel better about yourself and other people and help other people. That there really is improvement of all forms of your life, even after you stop drinking, in forms of your behavior and how you look about other people and how you deal with other people. That going to church and religion is not a dirty word or anything like that. You don't have to put down people or talk about them behind their back or anything like that. That the step six really is what they're talking about. That's what they're talking about. They say, So the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective, what you think is being a good man or a good woman, and for the perfect objective, which is of God. Many will at once ask, well, how can we accept the entire implication of step six? Why, that is perfection. This sounds like a hard question, but practically speaking, it isn't. It goes on to say, I'm not saying you're going to be perfect, but you shoot for that deal. Well, how are you going to shoot for that deal if you just stay satisfied and settle for yourself and you don't stretch? You don't stretch yourself by maybe hanging out with people that make you feel uncomfortable. Some guy, you know, tapped me on the shoulder. I was having a grand old time in Alcoholics Anonymous. A grand old time. Hey, it was great. I had like 15, 16 years. You had 15, 16 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a breeze. Nobody's going to call you down. Nobody's going to give you any crap. Everyone's, well, you know, I mean, you got it, you know. You're 15, 16 years, it's almost like you're cured, you know, and 17, 18 years, you can hang around here, you know all the things, you sponsor people, you do the steps. Some guy tapped me on the shoulder. He says, you ever been to a Bible study? What? I'm not going to go to a Bible. You know, I was scared. You know, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, they might, what was I scared of? I was scared because they might, you know, I don't even know what I was scared of. I was scared of a million things. Probably one of the things I was scared of is what is going to be expected of me. What are those people going to be like? Alcoholics understand me. They understand I'm screwed up. I'm stupid. I'm crazy. I do crazy things, and they love me. These people may not understand that. You know, I started going. I started hanging around these people. I met a bunch of my sponsors, a Baptist preacher. He's 57 years sober. I met him at a Bible study. I've been hanging around those people. You know, it's incredible. It's incredible. Now, I'm not telling you you got to go to a Baptist Bible study or a Presbyterian or you got to do all that. I'm just telling you that to put yourself in a box and not grow and not see what the sixth step is about is, and to somehow have contempt prior to investigation, which, by the way, is the definition of not doing the second step, and not understand what these guys were all about and what they were doing, is to not grow. And let me tell you something, you don't grow in here, you die. This is about moving on and growing in the image and likeness of your creator. Doing six and seven. Now, I'll tell you, you don't do six and seven, you don't grow, you don't keep on reaching, you don't keep on trying to go for that 11th step, getting closer to God. Let me tell you something, don't be looking for the promises. Don't be looking for that stuff these guys got. The rocket in the fourth dimension, the emotional sobriety. Don't be sitting around worrying about sucking your thumb, you know, and all that sort of stuff, saying, how come this isn't working for me? I got 19 years, and I'm hanging in there, you know what I mean? You know, and it ain't working for me. Don't be wondering what's going on. What's going on is you ain't doing it. You're being complacent. You're resting on your laurels, and you're headed for trouble when you do that stuff. And the reason you're doing that is because you don't want doing this any of this stuff because you're scared, and I get that. You know, or you just don't want to change. You just don't want to do it. What else could they be talking? You read the sixth step. And what, you know what would be really good? You read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. You see what they were doing between 1935 and 1939. And then in light of that, you read some of the statements in the big book that Dr. Bob said, that Bill Wilson said. The way they talked about God, and the way they, and then you read this thing, and then you try to figure out what they were talking about. And then you try to decide whether the kind of stuff I'm talking to you about is really off the wall, or really this is what they were about. They were into this stuff. And you know something? They were reaping the benefits from it. Just like you'll reap the benefits from it if you get involved in it. You know? Don't worry about what some guy in your group, whether he laughs at you or sells you stupid or whatever the heck it is, you know? I mean, you know, he's just an alcoholic. You're going to really worry about what an alcoholic thinks about you? I mean, for God's sakes, I mean, Lord, this ain't exactly Well People's Anonymous, you know? So God bless you. Thank you very much.
Spiritual MRI.